Athens nonprofit Project Safe is an organization that offers services to survivors of domestic violence. The next two stories come from women who received help from Project Safe and offer hope for other victims. Here's Suzanne Ward and her Project Safe advocate, Sarah Nitz.
Do you remember the first day you came in and met with me?
I do. It was a walk-in. It was the first time I talked to you. I didn't actually see you that day. Mm-hmm. It was a walk-in clinic.
I remember seeing you come in, though, out of the window, and you had blue scrubs on, and I was like, oh, there's a nurse here.
Mm-hmm.
That's just what I assumed.
I was trying to figure a way out of my situation and did not know Project Safe even existed, and it was a counselor who actually urged me, Phyllis, to first things first is figure out how to keep myself safe and keep my boys safe. And so the only times I had were in the middle of the day during work hours,
right.
The only time I could get away.
When you came in that day, like, what was your overall hope for, like, coming in? Like, what was your goal?
That nobody was hurt. I was in a desperate spiral. I didn't even have an agenda. I was just mm-hmm. in such a volatile situation that the only thing I knew was that I needed to find a way to keep myself and the boys safe. And also, I was concerned about my husband at the time,
mm-hmm.
his safety as well.
So on Monday, you came in, and by Friday, you had filed for a divorce and filed a protective order with an attorney. And so that's a lot to happen in 5 days.
Yeah, there was a lot leading up to it, for sure. Marriage, 18 years. And by the time I was actually saying out loud what was happening, it was a pretty desperate situation. And I didn't even recognize, I don't know if you remember, when I did come back in, I'd filled out some kind of paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so twisted up, I didn't even recognize how dangerous of a situation I was in.
Oh, I remember. I remember that.
And I didn't recognize what I was saying sounded, what it sounded like to other ears, because mm-hmm. when you're in that situation for so long, what becomes normal is so skewed. You lose your edges, mm-hmm. basically. And it was actually a coworker who finally kind of said, what is going on? You're not safe. That night, I knew, and it was a prayer. It was just, okay, it's like leaving a burning house. You don't wonder how you're going to get out. You mm-hmm. just start moving. And that's really what it felt like. There wasn't a plan in place.
How did you feel? Like, you know, because you're doing all these things kind of in secret.
Robotic. You know, there was, I had to have, as I did before, many discussions with my sons about what to do if.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget, it was Tuesday that I was sitting with him at the Chinese restaurant. It was like some bad Lifetime movie. And Jack said, Mom, we've been doing this for a long time. We've been taking care of each other for a long time.
Wow.
And it was just those words of thinking that I was doing such a good job of shielding it when actually they were very much a part of all mm-hmm. the trauma.
I remember very distinctly the many conversations we had where I was like, Suzanne, I get that you want to protect the boys, but you can't protect the boys if you don't protect yourself, too.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about, like, when you're on an airplane and they're going over the safety tips with you, they always tell you you have to put on your oxygen mask before you put on mm-hmm. someone else's.
But I'm glad I had the momentum of protecting the boys, because I don't think I would have
had... Oh, that fueled you for a long time.
And I don't know that I would have gotten to a place where I would have thought worthy enough of protecting myself. And now mm-hmm. I recognize that kind of janky thinking. But the reality is the energy to move us out of that situation came from my desire to protect them.
What was the most helpful thing to you in getting out and starting over?
You didn't shame me. I was so ashamed of that my children were suffering. You didn't have that, why are you still there? You didn't ask why. You just said, let's go.
You just go.
Get out and mm-hmm. trust that you will survive it.
Mm-hmm.
And not only survive it, you can live.
Mm-hmm. And have a good life.
And have a pretty
And enjoy
freaking,
it.
Yeah.
And.
And all its messiness.
Mm-hmm.
This conversation comes from Sherry Tanner, an advocate for domestic violence victims, and her friend, Becky Parker.
You told me you've been doing public speaking for domestic violence for, did you say 13 years now?
It's been 13 years.
How did that get started?
I had relocated with my insurance company, me and my husband, and my grown son was a teenager at the time. So we moved to Knoxville, Tennessee. And so after settling in, I wanted to get involved with a domestic violence program there and see what I could do to help out. I went there and said, I want to help. What can I do? And so they put me in touch with David Kitts. He's with the Knoxville Police Department. And he sat me down in his office and he says, so, you know, what's your story? Because I told him I had been through domestic violence myself. And he said, well, tell me all about it. So I sat and I told him from the start what I'd gone through. And when we were done, he's like, wow. He was telling me that he goes to police academy. He goes to the University of Tennessee and he does public speaking, you know, against domestic violence. And he said, I would love for you to join me and start telling your story. And he says, you could totally make a difference out there. And I had no idea I was ever going to be a public speaker. I was like, me doing something like that?
What was it you had in mind, like when you went to him and said, I want to help, which is really cool, by the way. But what did you have in mind that you would be doing for him? I'm curious.
I had no idea about public speaking. I was thinking, you know, well, if they needed help in the shelter.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, or whatever.
Or
things like
talking,
the hands-on stuff. It didn't cross my mind about doing any kind of speaking. Not at all. So I started out going to different things. When I first got started in it, it was like my third, I think it was the third time I went out and spoke was, it was a high school in Knoxville. And it was one of the classes there. And afterwards, this young girl came up to me and she hugged my neck. She had tears in her eyes. And she said that she had been dating this guy for a while that was abusive to her. And she was not happy and she was scared. She didn't know how to end it and things like that. And she said that something I said gave her the strength and she was going to totally break it off with him.
Oh, and, I must have given you and, chills, man.
Oh, my gosh. We both cried, you know. I was like, and it was that moment that I was like, wow, this is what I've got to continue doing.
Yeah.
Since I came back here in 2008, I contacted Project Safe and said, this is what I've been doing in
out
Knoxville.
There.
And if you need me to speak out here, I don't mind. I've been speaking out for Project Safe ever since. And I'm very, very honored.
You know, I wanted to say, when we talked about the fact that we were going to be doing this and chatted about different things to talk about, and one of the things I had wanted to ask you, who are some of your favorite heroes, to kind of open it out a little bit?
I have to say my heroes are those women before me that got away. I'm going to cry.
I know, man, I'm crying.
That got away from their abusers and were able to stay away. Those are heroes. It's hard.
Yeah.
It's so hard when you're going through it and you're told you're nothing without them. You'll never make it on your own. But then you have these women, these warriors that come into your life and they tell you, I was able to get away. There is a life out there without being abused. I love people and I want to see people happy because you've got this one life and you deserve happiness and nobody should beat you down.
Another Athens advocate, Cameron Tanner, was brought into the mobile booth by her mom, Chris, to talk about the heartbreaking tragedy that ultimately led Cameron to action years later.
Yeah, you've had a long road leading up to gun control activism. So I was hoping to look back a little bit on your childhood and where you came from and where you are now.
All right.
So try to think of some really, really early childhood memories, no matter how small or insignificant they may seem.
I mean, I do remember, of course, like going to the theater a lot, to Town and Gown. I also remember my dad trying to get me to touch a praying mantis because he thought it was really cool.
So you lost your dad when you were 7.
Yes.
At the theater that you'd previously mentioned. So tell me as little or much as you remember, as much as you want to.
Well, it was some sort of party. I was sitting next to him. And then he was on the ground.
What had happened?
He was shot.
Do you remember anything after that?
Not much.
So that day, that man came and, you know, killed your dad and Marie Bruce and Ben Teague. Those first few weeks were really hard.
I don't remember any of that.
Yeah, it's probably best. It was difficult for everybody. But, you know, because I was suddenly a single parent. I remember I used to think to myself, wow, how do single parents do it? And then there I was, suddenly a single parent, going, wow, now I understand. They just do because they have to. Last year is when I started to notice your love for activism. You came up to me and said, can we do the March for Our Lives?
Actually, I think you're the one who texted me and was like, do you want to go to D.C. for March for Our Lives?
Well, you had asked if you wanted to do that, but you were talking about the local one or maybe the Atlanta
one. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And at that point, I went, do you want to go to D.C.? Because this is the first time you had shown an outward interest in the gun control movement. What was that like?
That was pretty cool. It was really fun. There was a lot of positive energy, too, like all the support and everything. I could definitely tell that this was a movement that's primarily like young people.
Mm-hmm. I guess to flatly ask, when you started showing this interest, was it Parkland or was there something already brewing that I just wasn't seeing?
I was thinking about that. And what I think it was is that I kind of always had an issue with it, but I think I gradually just at some point kind of shut up about it because so many adults were like, nah, you're too young. You don't know well enough, despite, you know, I have experience now, so.
Yeah, you have more experience than most do. Absolutely. So you led your school walkout and you spoke publicly. You gave that speech.
Yeah.
That made me so proud.
Yeah. I actually, I think that what kind of awakened it was like when the March for Our Lives co-founder spoke out. And I was like, okay, so I'm not the only one. Like, I'm not crazy here. Somebody actually agrees with me. Like, other survivors agree with me. So I was like, okay, I'm going to jump on board with that. And this time I'm not going to shut up. So
that's great. Yeah, you spoke publicly about your father's death. As far as I know, that was the first time.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, that you had done that in front of a couple hundred of your peers on the mm-hmm. on the football field. So, and then you kind of continued watching the March for Our Lives as they'd started doing the Road to Change and mm-hmm. voter registration drives and such. So what's next for you?
That's a good question. So last year, I started the first Georgia chapter of the National Association of Students Against Gun Violence. So I kind of have that in the works at my school. It's not officially set up. And I'm talking with the Georgia chapter of March for Our Lives and the Georgia chapter of the Future Coalition. Whatever's next, I guess we'll find out.
It looks like you're ready for it.
Although she had a much different experience hundreds of miles away from Athens, immigration advocate Leedy Solis joined her friend JoBeth Allen to talk about her experience coming to the U.S. and how it shaped her future.
When did your parents come to the U.S.?
Well, as far as I remember, we came together as a family. I was maybe 2 years old, and then we ran out of money, and we had to come back. But the second time that I remember, I stayed with my grandparents, and my parents came with my little sister.
So eventually, you joined your family. Tell us about that.
Yes, so eventually they paid a coyote mm-hmm. for me to come to the U.S. And I was with my grandfather, but it was almost like a stranger because I wasn't really close to him. So I felt completely alone. It was a really traumatic. I feel like I didn't have nobody.
And what was the actual journey like?
My grandma told me that I had to leave, that I was going to go meet with my parents.
Mm.
I didn't understand what that meant. I just, mm-hmm. I thought it was just going to be a couple hours.
Mm.
It felt like months, like years. It felt like it took years to get to my parents. The actual crossing was very fast. I remember running. I remember a girl holding my hand. It wasn't my grandfather. And then I remember separating from my grandfather. And I was scared because we were running like as if we were running from something bad. Mm. I didn't understand what it was and I didn't understand why I had to run. But she was grabbing me. I was so hungry. I just keep on remembering that. And we went under a bus and stayed there for a couple hours. Mm. I was hot and I was sweaty. And finally, we got out and we met with my grandfather again. And I just wanted to be over so bad. I just wanted to go back with my grandmother and just be in her arms. And as a child, to go from one place to another, not knowing why or not knowing why you have to go through that journey, is so hard. Now, I don't know how I could pay my parents back because they did all of that for a better future for me. I don't know how I can ever repay them.
How did you learn that you were undocumented?
In high school, all my friends started to get their license and they started to apply for colleges and talk about all these exciting things that I was also excited about. And they would ask me what college would I go to, and I would tell them I'm going to UGA because it's close to me. I don't have to leave my family. And then I remember I was going home and I asked my mom, can we go get my license? And she stood quiet for a minute and she said, you can't get your license. And I asked why, and she said, you just can't. You're not a citizen. You're not from here. You can't do that. And so then I was like, but what about, like, I had so many questions. I was like, what about college? What about my job? What about, you know, all my dreams? And my mom was like, I'm sorry. Like, I wanted to talk to you about this, but like, I didn't know how. Like, you can't get your license. I don't think you can really go to college. And that's when my American dream changed, because all of a sudden, I felt like I had to start all over. You know, when I first heard about the American dream, it was in class. The teacher asked a bunch of students, what is the American dream for you? And most of their answer was, get a degree, get a car, get a house, and have this wonderful life.
Right.
And I remember just writing that my American dream was peace and feeling welcomed and feeling like I will always have my family without anybody trying to take it away, and being hopeful. My American dream is just to be in peace and not feel fear.
Our experiences sometimes lead us through difficult times in life, but Reverend Paul Baxley and Rabbi Eric Linder discuss their interfaith work in Athens and offer a message of hope.
One of my favorite memories of my time here in Athens as pastor at First Baptist Church is the evening you invited two other colleagues and me to join you for the short symposium in your congregation.
Yeah.
I think that was one of the early significant chances we had to be together and talk about our faith traditions and their differences and their similarities. That was a really, really special night.
Yeah. And I think you and I share this perspective that interfaith work isn't about the idea of, oh, we're all the same and we all believe the same God, which we may. I happen to not believe that. But really that it's our differences that make us interesting and special, and we should in some ways focus on those differences and learn from them and appreciate them.
It's dawned on me more and more over time that our distinction is what makes us most unique. It's in our distinction that we might most reflect the image of God. And we have to recognize that God is not a God of sameness, but instead a God who is adventurous and creates a world
like
with more diversity than we could ever imagine or comprehend or grasp or limit. And so the more I come to terms with the creative, adventurous character of God, then the more I'm drawn to recognizing that God is at work beyond my narrow experience.
Yeah. And what's interesting to me about that is precisely because of that, we sometimes step on each other's feet. By doing this work, we are necessarily going to sometimes offend each other and sometimes upset each other. And I like that. I think we as a group recognize that the goal isn't never to do that. The goal is to do that and then move from that. You know, when you were talking, Paul, I was thinking about what our friend Adel taught us, the local imam, that that in the Quran it says that God created man and woman so that we get to know each other, or God created different tribes so that we get to know each other. And I think that's a kind of foundational principle that certainly moves me.
Yeah, it's interesting. When we first started organizing this interfaith partnership, and we're also having our first interfaith service, I remember we started planning for that first interfaith Thanksgiving service in the late spring, early summer of 2016. And we were going to do it at Thanksgiving. And I don't think any of us imagined what was going to happen in the political arena between May, June of 2016 and November of 2016.
Yeah.
But, you know, somewhere around early November of 2016, I think it became clear to all of us that we had a bigger mission, because we were living in a world that was more and more being trained to fear difference.
You know, I use this story all the time. There's this beautiful story in the Talmud of Rabbi Hillel and Shammai, who were always at loggerheads with one another. There was this time where they were having a debate, because that's what Jews do. And Hillel said one thing and Shammai said another, and God's voice comes down, which in the Talmud is actually a pretty rare thing. It's the explicit voice of God is fairly absent from the Talmud. And God says that both of you reflect the words of God. Only one of you can be right. There is an answer. Both of your thoughts and opinions reflect the words of the holy God. And like, that says so much to me about how to disagree, how to talk to people that are different, come from different cultures, different backgrounds. And gosh, I wish we had that in our country right now.
One of our colleagues said, in this day and age, if we can just be together and be friends, that will be a witness in and of itself.
Yeah,
almost
right.
No matter what else we say in that service or what else happens.
Or a prayer
or,
of
you
a
know,
sort.
The dynamic of clergy of different faith traditions being together in obvious, genuine friendship is a healthy challenge for us, but also a witness to the larger culture that I think is true to all of our traditions. So do we have any advice for people who are struggling with how to respond to difference?
I think humility is a part of it. There's a quote that I read somewhere that the scariest thing is the utter conviction that you're 100% right. And so allowing space in your own head that you're not 100% right, you need to be willing to hear where the other person is coming from. But that being said, if someone says something that's explicitly hateful or misogynist or racist, just don't talk to them. Part of, I think, society's problem is we're trying to change the minds of some who are not really willing to come to the table. But I think the vast majority of people are willing to have some part of their mind changed. And so my advice would be humility and a little patience.
Our final conversation comes from some of Athens' newest residents who share that moving is often an adjustment. Carl and Halo Smart talk with their children Isadora and Clyde about their recent move from California.
Hello, my name is Izzy Smart.
And who's here with you?
My mommy, Halo, my brother, Clyde Smart, and my daddy, Carol.
So, Isadora, this question is for you. When you first heard we were moving to Georgia, what were some of your first thoughts?
I thought that cousins were moving to a different house.
You thought your cousins were going to move into a different house? Oh, you thought that Wyatt and Ava were going to come here too? Yeah. Okay. How about you, Clyde? What were some of your first thoughts when you heard we were moving to Georgia?
Well, I was a little scared about how was it going to be different. I liked the part where I knew my cousins were going to be a lot closer and my Nana.
Izzy, what made you excited and what made you nervous?
What made me excited is like I'll have new friends. The nervous thing, I'll leave my friends.
You were nervous about leaving friends and happy about making friends. Clydie, how about you? What made you nervous?
I knew if I was going to be at a new school, I would have to find more friends. And now I feel a little better because I have friends now. How did you feel?
I felt both excited and nervous. I felt excited about having a more mellow life because we lived in the middle of a big city and it was pretty hectic. And so I was excited about a more quiet, calmer pace of life. But I was nervous about leaving family. Yeah, and just the very different kind of culture here. So I was nervous about how that would be.
Well, I'm the person who sort of decided that we should move. I mean, we decided together. So I think I was most nervous just about how it would be for our family, moving back home to Georgia. Seemed a little daunting. I guess ultimately just I wanted the kids to be happy. I really came so I could be close to my parents who were getting older. And it's been nice to spend time with them and to spend time with my brother who's here in Athens and my sister who's in Atlanta. But I was excited for being back in a place where we could hear all the bugs and all the sounds and being back in a greener place and having a more simple lifestyle. And I wanted the kids to also understand kind of where they're from in terms of the South and culture and the people here. And
what do you like about it here?
The commute.
Yeah, the commute. No traffic. Not a peep of traffic. Even though we drive far sometimes to go out to Isadora's school, it's on a country lane, and there's not a whole lot of congestion.
And my school is far away from here.
Clyde's is very close, and my work is very close. Yeah, our house is right next to my work.
I think my favorite thing about it is, yeah, the commute, but that just means that Daddy's working less, and I get to see you guys more. We get to spend more time as a family.
Are you glad we moved, or are you...
I'm happy that we stayed in Alameda.
You wanted to stay in Alameda.
It's Athens.
Daddy, what about you?
I'm in the middle.
Yeah, we're still adjusting. I'm still adjusting. Let's go get these squiggly kids to the park for sure. You guys can't hold still another minute.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of StoryCorps Athens. These stories were recorded locally at the StoryCorps mobile booth at the Athens-Clarke County Library in the fall of 2018. StoryCorps is part of a national initiative to record and preserve the stories of everyday people. All of these interviews were produced locally by Morgan Fry. For WUGA, I'm Kathy Bradbury.